advise the committee as to why you would make that motion at this time. It seems to me that we're past deadlines and we've made some decisions in this committee. And so I'm wondering if you could just give a little advice as to how we should vote and why.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Artman, I think that there's going to be some further discussion in the Tax Committee on this issue that will enlighten us and perhaps better improve the bill. And I would like the opportunity to continue to work on these important issues. We all know that this is important to Minnesota to have clean water and good outdoors, and I'd like to consider the discussion.
Senator Ortman, it's really kind of a courtesy to reconsider, and then we certainly can have the discussion, but Senator Ortman?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that I'd like to give Senator Scoy all the courtesy that I can, because I he is always very professional, and I support his positions almost always. But I'm concerned here at the precedent that we have a committee hearing after all the deadlines on a bill that we determined previously would not pass this committee. And so now we're going to change the rules, and we're going to reconsider a bill that is past deadline and does not have a companion in the House. And so I find it striking that we would be doing that now. And I will oppose the motion to reconsider. I will look forward to the conversation about the merits of the bill and the amendments that will be offered after that. But I want to make sure that my opposition to the reconsideration is noted.
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Artman, I don't think there are deadlines in the Tax Committee.
No. Correct, Senator Scoy. On the SCOI motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Senate File 6 is reconsidered and in front of the committee. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer the A15 amendment. And, Mr. Chairman, while this is being distributed, I'll explain. I think this is an amendment I had offered a couple weeks ago, and it was a voice vote, and it looked to me to be awfully close. This is one that would change it to a statutory dedication. And as I explained at that time, I don't think, looking at the purpose of the Constitution is to protect rights and to set up a framework of government. I don't think it's appropriate to be budgeting that way. And as Senator Langseth pointed out, the transportation amendment last year, we shouldn't be budgeting this way. And I believe that dedication is reasonable, but statutory dedication, where we dedicate certain taxes to pay for certain things, because of the nature of this, where we're looking at long-term funding, I'm willing to, I think that that's a reasonable way to go. And so this simply changes the bill. It doesn't change anything else about it, but does convert it from a constitutional dedication to a statutory dedication. And I explained it last time. I think people understand the issue.
Questions, members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
Mr. Chair, I have come to the conclusion I mentioned before about placing things in the Constitution. I was chairman of the Transportation Committee for 14 years, and I always wanted 100% of NVES to go into transportation. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought it should be statutory rather than in the Constitution. So I actually went to the polls and voted against that. And, of course, we had another amendment last year which would have put it in the Constitution, which I voted against as well. I just think I'm pretty conservative when it comes to the Constitution, and I just don't think that we should change the Constitution unless there's some real need to do so. And it kind of seems to me what we're doing is using constitutional amendments to sort of go around our responsibility as a legislature. And I did feel bad about my vote here the other day because we do need the money for these purposes. I really do think that if we're going to have arts in there, we also should have had a public radio and TV and so on. But that, this has got quite a ways to go. But I supported the Marty Amendment here the other day, said that I would have voted for the bill if it had made it. So I do support the Marty Amendment.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, this then would just operate as another sales tax increase. Is that correct?
Senator Ortman, what this would do would be to increase the sales tax by the same 3/8% that the bill currently does. It doesn't change any of that, and it dedicates the funding to these same purposes. I'm not tinkering with the percentages or anything, just leaving it the same as it is in the bill.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, perhaps a question for Senate Counsel. If we pass this with the dedication, future legislatures can change the dedication or reverse the dedication. Is that your advice, or is that true? Is that the way it operates?
Mr. Chair, Senator Orman, that is correct. If it's statutory, future legislatures could change the statute.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Orman.
And my comment would be that we're just spending money based on another sales tax. There's no real dedication here. There's only the hope that maybe we'll continue to use these funds for these purposes, but the legislature would have all the flexibility in the world to spend these dollars any way they would like. And so I'm not in favor of the Marty Amendment.
Senator Ortman, it's more than hope. This will be law. And this will be built into base budgets under current law. It's not fair to characterize this as a hope that the money will be spent in these program areas. Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair and members, I've only been here 5 years, but back in local government days in the early 90s, I remember something called a local government trust fund. And that was a fund that was set aside, supposedly, to provide almost a guaranteed level of local government aid on into the future for local communities. And, of course, I'm not sure if that lasted maybe a couple years. And I suspect there's probably only three or four people around this table that even remember the local government trust fund. But I fear that going this way, while it might get it off the table today, certainly is far from permanent, far from the Legacy Act that we all talk about in terms of preserving water, wildlife, and other good things. So, again, while the statutory approach may be something that moves this bill along today, I just really do fear that it's not going to be around for a long time.
Well. Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, well, it failed to receive support in its previous form in this committee. We're trying to keep the idea alive. So I'm not understanding quite the comments of Senator Senjum. I mean, if he's against the idea, he's against the idea. We're trying to figure out what might gain the kind of support to get this thing, move this thing forward, because we think it's an important enough idea.
Well, yeah, thank you, Senator Dibble. I think, members, this bill does have to have 34 votes on the floor of the Senate, too. And I, for one, am concerned that the constitutional amendment may not have that. And I think funding for these budget areas is important, and there's no question they've been underfunded. And I think putting a proposal together that can get the votes on the Senate floor is very, very important, and I think this moves us closer to accomplishing that. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Senjum and Senator Ortman just talked about how they believe this is so important. We provide this funding, and yet, oh, the legislature is going to change it like that. I think every member of this committee said they support this funding. They support funding for natural resources, for environment, for all these purposes. And then they talk about how this is going to change right away. And the governor, I know he was the one who cut the 2-cent cigarette tax from the Future Resources Fund while saying how he cares about conservation. You know, all we have to do is put our money where our mouths are. That's what the legislative process is about. If we support funding for future generations, we vote for it. That's what the process is about, saying that, oh, well, we're going to put this in law and then we're not going to fund it because, well, we changed our mind. Well, say now you don't support the funding for natural resources if that's the case. But I hear bipartisan calls for we got to support natural resources. I've been willing to support and vote for and pay for the taxes to fund this for years. I think we need it for our kids and our grandkids. I think it's very important. And for people to say, oh, we really support this, but, oh, if we put it in statute, dedicate it even in statute, oh, we're going to change it right away. And I just think that, Senator Ortman, if you support this, if the governor supports this, well, what's the problem?
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, the idea of a statutory dedication is artificial, and it doesn't mean anything. It will just turn into another tax grab and another slush fund for the legislature. It was only last year that this tax committee watched as our statutes, our law, was overturned and made an exemption of for the Twin Stadium, we said as a matter of law that we would not pass local option sales taxes without referendums, but we did it anyway last year. We can dedicate and make this law, but next year it can change. There will be elections in 2 years and 4 years, and things will change. There's no way to guarantee for Minnesotans that if we raise their sales tax, that they're going to see this benefit. No way at all. Only a promise, a wing, and a hope.
Senator Ortman, do not underestimate the power of base-level budgeting. I mean, I've chaired a finance division and seen the governor's budget. And remember, the governor has to propose a budget under current law. So a governor will have to propose a budget under the provisions in this bill if it passes into law. And base-level budgeting is very, very significant for chairs that chair finance divisions. I just don't think Senator Ortman characterizing this as a hope is at all accurate. I mean, the governor will have to submit a budget to the legislature based on current law, and that means base level. And it is not that easy for the legislature to move money out of the base. I've carried a bill. I know how hard that is. I just don't think you should underestimate the power of putting something in law. Any other discussion, members? On the Marty A15 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no?
No.
Motion prevails. A15 is adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, I feel a little wounded. Hope I'm not roadkill. But I'd move that Senate File 6 as amended. We recommend to pass, re-refer to the Rules Committee. Committee on Rules.
On the Pogemiller motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Senator Pogemiller.
It was an experience.
For all of us. Members, the next bill is Senate File 610, which is a department bill. Do you have a moment?
Everybody leaves.
Remember, Senate File 610 is in front of us. Senator Larson moves the A2 amendment. Members, this is a department bill. We have included this article, as you see it, in the Delete Everything Amendment into the omnibus tax bill, so it's already passed. We've flushed everything out of here. What we're simply trying to do here is get ourselves a Senate File up to the floor so that we can have some flexibility in working with the House, in the final 12 days of the session here, in the event there's a governor's veto or something, we have an opportunity to have a vehicle to bring this session to a timely conclusion. That's no intent other than that. There's no other kind of plan for it. Just simply want to have some balls in the air as we move towards closing the session up. On the Larson motion to adopt the A2 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. On Senate, Senator Larson moves Senate File 610 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Senate File 2249, members, is the TIF technical bill. That came to us real late. I don't know exactly what the bill introduction date was, but it was after we had passed our omnibus bill out of the committee. We do see a TIF technical bill every year that comes. Well, council can explain who puts it together. I think it's the people that work on TIF, work with the department and others for some small little technical corrections to TIF. I thought it would be important for the committee to know what's in here because the House has included these TIF technical provisions into their omnibus bill. I expect that as we negotiate the omnibus bill with the House, these are provisions that we're certainly going to want to consider and likely could be included in the omnibus bill. So I thought it would be important for the committee to see these provisions before we actually consider negotiating their terms with the House. So, Council?
Mr. Chair, members, you just received a summary of the TIF technical bill, Senate File 2249, and these provisions are extremely technical, so I'll just run through them briefly. If anyone has any questions, just let me know. Section 1 is an amendment to the definition of redevelopment district, and this provision recurs throughout the bill. Under current law, there was an effort when the redevelopment district's provisions were enacted to make sure that not a lot of bare land would be included in redevelopment district, that instead a redevelopment district would be created for the purpose of removing blight. So for that reason, there are prohibitions throughout the law on the inclusion of bare land in these districts. There is a later provision, though, that amends the definition of substandard buildings, which trigger the designation of redevelopment districts, to include improvements such as utilities, buildings, streets, paved or gravel parking lots, or similar structures, so that those are considered to have been improved lots. The amendment in Section 1 and some other, also Section 2, would provide that when the parcels contain these kinds of improvements, they would be treated the same as substandard buildings for qualification for inclusion in redevelopment districts. Subdivision 2 does the same thing for renewal and renovation districts. Sections 3, 6, 10, and 11 eliminate the term qualified housing district that was used within the TIF law. It had originally been devised as creating an exemption to the LGA HACA offset for TIF districts. So it was an even more stringent definition of what would qualify as low to moderate income housing. We no longer have that offset, and the decision was made since qualified housing districts were not very different from ordinary housing districts within the TIF law to just consolidate them. So all housing districts within the TIF law will now be just designated as housing districts. Section 4 would allow the state auditor to exempt an authority from reporting excess increments if the authority certifies that the total amount authorized by the plan to be paid with increments from the district exceeds the sum of the total increments collected for the district for all years. In the omnibus bill, the House has set that at a 20% threshold. And the point of this is to recognize the reality that it's unlikely that there will be excess increments in this situation. Section 5 just clarifies that either publicly or privately owned parking structures may be financed with tax increment. Section 7 allows an authority to treat an addition to an existing structure as a separate building, and this is with respect to the limitation on expenditures of increment for non-housing purposes within a housing district. Authorities are prohibited from spending more than 20% of the increments on non-housing components of a housing district. This section clarifies the procedure that would be used when there's an addition to an existing structure in a housing district. Section 8 requires county auditors to certify the original net tax capacity of a new district within 30 days after receipt of the request for certification. Currently, there's one county, Ramsey County, that has been certifying districts just at the time when they receive the first increment, and a lot of the timing restrictions in the law would relate to the time of certification. So the intent here is to make this uniform and make it occur within 30 days after receipt of the request. Section 9 is just a technical correction to some language in the section dealing with interfund loans. Just a couple of words have been dropped out in an amendment. And that's it.
Questions, members? All pretty technical stuff. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Section 5, parking, publicly or privately owned parking structure. Have we've allowed public structure, parking structures in the past?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, yes, this is intended to be just a clarification that it could be publicly or privately owned.
And Mr. Chairman is up with the Mall of America project. I presume that parking ramp is privately owned. This would, I don't know the specifics of that proposal. I'm just curious. Right now, that's not clear whether that would be allowable. This would make that allowable.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, I believe this is intended more to clarify that it would be available for a publicly owned parking structure as well. The existing language, the intent of the underlying law has been to prohibit the use of tax increments for public buildings. It was intended to avoid using tax increment to get around levy limits at the time. So the intention was really the other way.
Anything else, members? Senator Larson moves that Senate File 2249 be recommended to pass. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Senator Cohen here?
Yeah, he just came in.
Members, this is another late introduction. You'll see by the bill number 2276. The TIF bill was 2249. This is even later. And I thought the committee should also see this because the House, because their bill came out much later than ours, they do have some language in their bill about some incentives for to encourage film production in our state. So before the conferees move forward and have too much of a discussion about the House provisions, I thought it would be helpful for the committee to see this bill and maybe have a discussion about the worthiness of offering credits or some kind of cash incentives for film productions that be done in Minnesota. Senator Cohen, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. Let me just offer a little bit of history, if I might, for just a minute.
We have a little history? You said little history.
Little history. Little history. Obviously, that's subject to interpretation, but let me try to match your interpretation. Mr. Chairman and members, the Film Board of Minnesota has undergone a couple of different lives. When I first established the Film Board back when I was in the House, it was in more of the infancy days of film boards around the country. And the Minnesota Film Board did well during the 1980s. Obviously, the golden era for Minnesota film production was the 1990s, and I think members are familiar with the productions, the major productions that came into the state, as well as secondary productions. And the history has certainly been that the existence of the film industry in Minnesota has been, at least at that time, was significant. It created several thousand jobs basically out of whole cloth, many of them union jobs. The cause and effect was significant in terms of very limited tax dollars put into the effort the commensurate production of tax dollars directly to general revenue, even separate from the significant economic spinoff, depending on how members view such calculations. What happened, however, by the end of the 90s is that there was a combination of two things that, in effect, collapsed the film industry. And I should add, and Ms. Winter, who's now been the executive director for the last couple of years, can correct me if I'm mistaken. I think during that period of time, Minnesota was actually, after L.A., the fourth largest production market in the country. You had Los Angeles, obviously, and then you had New York, North Carolina, Texas, and then Minnesota, if I'm not mistaken, in terms of size of domestic film production. What happened at the end of the 1990s, however, were two things. First of all, you had all the state deficits. So as states were cutting budgets around the country, they cut film boards. And that happened in Minnesota as well. Minnesota maintained kind of a skeleton film board at that point. Second, the Canadian exchange rate made some drastic changes. It became significantly less expensive to make films in Canada as opposed to the United States. And the largest film production center after L.A. became Toronto, followed by Vancouver, because the exchange rate was so favorable. What's happened now are a couple of things. And the reason for this legislation are a couple of things. First of all, there's been an evening out of the domestic film production. Exchange rate between Canada and the United States. And so now it's more profitable for producers to come back to the United States. Second, however, the other significant change has been the growth of film incentives. Minnesota actually had some of the first incentives back when the original Snowbait program was introduced, I believe in 1999, was among the first. I don't have any pins to pass out, Mr. Chairman. I just am here with my bill. Minnesota had the first rebate program, I think in the nation, if I'm not mistaken, which was a much smaller program. But what happened is the production, the domestic production market increased in the first part of this decade, is states started to develop significant incentives in order to get the production companies here. There still is a significant amount of economic activity, spinoff activity, and direct tax dollars to the state absent a film board and the incentives. But there is the need for incentives. The gold standard is New Mexico. New Mexico has legislation which provides a tax credit, a rebate, and they use their mineral trust fund. And New Mexico has now become the biggest domestic production market outside of L.A. in the United States and Canada. Minnesota, having been ahead of the curve, is now behind the curve. And what we've done this year, or what we did last year, is we reinstated the Snowbait. Members might recall in the supplemental finance bill, we had approximately, I think, $1.7 million provided for the rest of the biennium. In this year's economic development bill, which the governor's vetoed, we'll see what happens, we have $2.5 million provided. That actually is somewhat less than would be the optimum figure. But what happens in other states is you have a combination of rebates and tax credits. And that's what brings this legislation. I'm going to ask Ms. Winter to explain how this is integrated with what they're doing with this particular bill, which provides the 20% credit. One of the things that, however, was made clear to us is approximately 3 weeks ago, several of us had a chance to have to meet and have dinner with the producer of all of the executive producer of all the Coen Brothers movies. Now, I'm not sure how many people around the table are film fans. The Coen Brothers, spelled differently, C-O-E-N. The Coen Brothers, originally from St. Louis Park, have been among the major successful producers, particularly at mid-range films. But obviously, their classic film, which was made here, was Fargo. They have another production that they're working on. What Mr. Graff, the producer, indicated to us is it's actually set in Minnesota. They would love to make the production here. It's a $13 million production by Hollywood standards that's mid-sized to small. But they also look at the bottom line. And the bottom line they look at is some type of arithmetic that would come up to a figure of 20% and a figure arrived easily. So this legislation is in the aftermath of, as the chairman indicated, what the House is doing in the aftermath of that meeting. And so my thought was is that if we could establish a Senate position, I realize that money will be quite difficult. And, Mr. Chairman, you'd know better than I, along with your conferees, as to whether or not there's the ability to even secure tax credits for anything this year. That gets into other kinds of arguments. But at least wanted to keep this issue in front of the committee and in front of the legislature. Again, I'll reiterate that in the 1990s, we had the legislature and the film production community in Minnesota had created an industry out of whole cloth that employed thousands of Minnesotans. I'll just add one other mention that with the collapse of the domestic film production, a lot of these people left the state to go to where the work was, notably California and New York. It's coming back. The film board has done some significant work, particularly over this last year, in getting some of the smaller independent productions. In fact, there was a front-page article in the Tribune yesterday about that. This effort would continue that. So, Mr. Chairman, we've distributed how the Snowbait has worked, and then Ms. Winter can talk about the legislation, what she's been doing, and how this particular legislation would dovetail with that.
Mr. Chair, my name is Lucinda Winter. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Film and TV Board. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we currently have a rebate. It was published and began to be open for applications in August, so I've had actually less than a year to get it cranked up and going. It's a diversified program in that it not only rebates money to filmmakers, but also people who make commercials, people who make documentaries and music videos and a TV series. And I think the diversification is important. They all create jobs. They all bring some of their folks here, and sometimes it's people from here who have bid on a job from outside the state and have brought it in here. They all bring money here. They all hire people here. So it's good that we have a diversified program. Although I think that everybody views the sexy part of the program as being features, the fact of the matter is that they all generate payroll taxes for us. Another thing that's interesting that over the course of the last year I have had in terms of how this, I've had almost 30, as of today, I think 30 applicants. Only two have not been approved, and they're in various stages of having been paid or their reimbursement requests are being processed right now. They're an interesting mix. There are commercials, there are TV series, 7 films, and 1 very large documentary that's being funded by the science museums across the United States. Another thing that's interesting to note is that some of the features that have shot or are shooting are all over greater Minnesota. We've had a film shoot in Cloquet. In the last 6 months, we've had a film shoot in the Moorhead area. There is a film slated to come here in 2008. It's a Garrison Keillor film that will be shot in the St. Cloud area. And as everyone knows, Sweetland had, which was shot in Montevideo, had a very nice impact on that area of our state. Currently, we have a feature film shooting in the Twin Cities metro area that is shooting both in the downtown area and in some of the outlying towns. I can't emphasize how important it is for us to have an incentive program. As far as producers are concerned, whether it's a rebate or a tax credit isn't as important to them as the amount of the fund. They want to know that there's enough money in your fund so that when they come and make their movie, they have some, we don't guarantee anything, but that they have some assurance that there'll be enough money in the fund for them to actually get their rebate. Credits come in 2 flavors. They come in a transferable and non-transferable. Non-transferable tax credits, in the case of our industry, the one I would opt for in would be non-transferable, because then you involve a broker in transferable tax credits, and some of the person's credit actually goes to a broker, which I'm against. But what's important in the mind of producers who are looking at our state, who are shopping our state as a place to work and for people to come here and hire people and spend their money, is the amount, and 15% is modest. Right now, just so you know, and I don't know that we have to get into a horse race, but just to let you know what's out there, Connecticut currently has a 30% incentive, and people are flocking to Connecticut. Production companies are flocking to Connecticut. Louisiana was their economy was probably brought back from the dead by the fact that they have very quickly turned themselves into a production center with their incentive program. And Governor Richardson in New Mexico made a choice to really turn New Mexico into a production center. He succeeded very well with his package of incentives. So to be in the game at all, to keep young people here who want entry into the marketplace here and would like to work here, and to bring in those tax dollars, this is a clean industry. The money comes in very quickly. Once you open the doors and start offering an incentive, it's a quick turnaround until you start seeing revenue. I guess the argument would be, at the very worst, this is revenue neutral, and all these states are doing this because it's very revenue positive. And it's, you know, it's, so I'll certainly entertain questions.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cohen, or perhaps your witness, might be able to answer this question. Has there been any, I see that on this handout that you have dispersed to the
right.
committee, there's some conclusions, and I'm not sure what they're based on. I tried to read it carefully. There's mm-hmm. some footnotes on the Department of Commerce,
right.
and estimates are based on actual information provided by production companies. Has there been any type of study a formal study of sorts or a task force that's been created to study this whole industry and how it interrelates with state programs of how to encourage these programs?
In our state or just in general?
Well, I would go for anything. I just would like to have more than just a footnote to make these presumptions and rely on them.
Right. For one thing, on the micro level, and thank you for the question and Chair Bach and members. What we did when we worked with Bob Isaacson, who's a fiscal analyst for the state. We asked him for the factoring numbers that are commonly used. And we took the reimbursement requests that have come in, been analyzed, and been paid. And we looked at those numbers and generalized them to the entire amount. So in other words, if we had 10, we looked at, say, 10 projects. In most cases, labor is 30 to 50% of your total rebate. It's labor costs. So we generalized that to our entire 1.7. So on a micro level, we tried to do the best we could to use commonly accepted factors for the direct and spinoff activity, and we based this on what we were really seeing come in. One of the things that is in this, in Senator Cohen's bill, is a study which absolutely support. I would love to see a study done. I don't know of any, which doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I'm sure other states have done their own studies. There is a certain amount of competition between states, as you might guess, so people are not very willing to share. But I don't know for a fact that there is a study that directly addresses what you're asking. I'm sure there might be.
If you have that capsulized in any way of how you came up with these numbers, I'd like to see them. Could you find that? Maybe a copy to everyone on the committee would be helpful. Because these numbers, they look impressive, and if we can see how you arrived at them, it would be a good direction to go. It seems like a good investment. One other question I did have is, and I don't know if Senator Cohen may know this, but I know that when we have professional ball players playing in Minnesota, if they visit Minnesota, their portion of that income that they play here has to be taxed on Minnesota income tax rates. And as they travel around the country, it's pretty much a done deal that the arrangement is that every ball player in any state in the country, wherever they go, have to pay that percentage of their income to that particular state. Do we do that with commercial film industry, the actors, and that type of thing? Do we split that income that way as well?
Sure. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the current program, the way we've devised the rules, we're pretty absolutist with the letter of the law. If you have to be a person who lives in Minnesota or a company that is a Minnesota company, Minnesota corporation, in order for the producer to receive a rebate. What that means is if you hire Minnesota acting talent, and we use a property tax statement and a driver's license to confirm residency, you will receive a rebate. If you hire somebody who's living in L.A. and bring them in, you do not receive a rebate. Now, this varies state by state. For example, New Mexico, if you bring in Bruce Willis, they're going to pay a rebate on his fee. So it's they have just recently, because I think they realize the horse is out of the barn, they have now capped that at $5 million per production. I mean, just to give you a sense of what some of the states are doing, they shot Wild Hogs in New Mexico, and their rebate check, and this just tells you what the budget was, their rebate check was $6 million. So New York has a $60 million rebate. So the rules change wherever you go, whatever state. In Montana, you don't get a rebate unless you not only have the word Montana in a movie on the screen somewhere, but you have to say Montana in the. So it's all over the place. We really have there's about almost only four states that do not have some sort of serious incentive to bring production in. Ours is what I would call a modest program, but actually that's a very good thing because this is a program I have to grow. We have had so many of our people leave, our production designers, our sound people, our actors, that it's going to take me some time to recruit back the crew I need to handle a $30 million movie.
Mr. Chair, you talked about production costs. Production costs, does that include actor salaries?
Yes, only...
But that's the salaries that are paid out. That isn't the... I'm thinking more of the actual income tax on the individual, not the production company, but the individual. Take, for example, you have a professional Chicago baseball team that comes here.
Mm-hmm.
That individual who's a ball player will be taxed a percentage of his income based on Minnesota taxation rates.
Right.
And so if you have an actor who's, let's say, getting a high production actor who's getting $20 million to do a film.
Right.
Let's say that film takes 1 year and it's all produced in Minnesota
right.
during that year. Would that income be taxed according to Minnesota income tax rates, or would it be out of their home state?
They have to pay, just like ball players, actors, like some actors might pay income tax, state income taxes in seven states in a year. And that's where that's why they have a team of accountants, because they're trying to keep all this straight. Currently in the rebate program, as it's structured with the rules that we have published on the web, I will not rebate a production company if, say, we'll just pick on Bruce Willis again, if he came here and shot a movie. The percentage of those income taxes that he pays to our state are not currently rebatable. Now, that's a very interesting idea, and it's something that producers come to me and ask me if we can do, because it helps everything, because obviously it's money into the state coffers. It would be a change not in the statute but in my production, in my rules that I have published, which we will only change once a year at the beginning of our fiscal, and we are looking at some ways. For example, there's some equipment you cannot get in Minnesota because we're not a big enough production market. A camera car is one example. That's a car that pulls another car, and you've seen them in Hollywood. I would also consider changing that so that if you cannot get a piece of equipment in Minnesota and you bring it in through a Minnesota company, so say Cinequipped, our biggest equipment house, brought it in for them, and of course they'd mark up for the service, that we could rebate that. These are all the kinds of questions I get from producers, and there are refinements that you can make to the program. But the one you bring up is probably the most interesting one, because it would increase the amount of state income tax that's brought in.
Senator Limmer, let me ask the question a little more directly, because I think you've got a good question. Senator Cohen, when the movie North Country was filmed in Minnesota, or part of it, did Charlize Theron or Woody Harrelson pay any Minnesota income tax?
Mr. Chairman, I was going to pose that to Ms. Winter, because I honestly don't know.
They have to, if they're payroll, they're national payroll companies that will follow a movie through wherever. If they shoot in eight locations, and in eight states, and they work in eight states and it depends on how, some of the times not all their money comes in wages, some of it comes in points after the movie. So, in other words, if, again, Bruce Willis comes in and shoots a movie, he will get some wages. He will also get some points on the back end if that's his deal for that movie. But when people, even when crew go and work in other states, okay, if we have a sound guy who works in Minnesota and he works in New Mexico, he pays, when he's working in New Mexico, he pays New Mexico. Assuming they're in a state that has a state income tax, he will pay state income taxes there. Some states don't, and they won't do that. But if they'll pay wage, they'll pay income taxes in the state where they're working and where the production company is running the project out of.
I see our Commissioner of Revenue is here. Commissioner, can you send us a memo and tell us how we treat out-of-state actors when they come to Minnesota,
spend
a few days here on a movie, how the Department of Revenue treats that, what kind of compliance we might have with that?
Chairman, I'd be happy to, but it is analogous to Senator Limmer's point. It's analogous to game days for professional athletes. So if Charlize Theron was here for 20% of the time, she was in the state of Minnesota filming North Country. I know some of it was filmed in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm,
also.
Right.
20% of the income attributable to being in Minnesota, of her salary would have been paid in Minnesota income tax. So it's just analogous to the way we treat professional athletes. Entertainers, Billy Joel does a concert at the Excel Center. He would pay income on the amount of his fee for that for that performance. So it's analogous to that, Chairman. We can put a memo together. It spells it all out.
I think the committee would like to see that. Thank you. Now, Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, isn't it the same for everyone? If you live in Hudson, Wisconsin, and you work here, your income is taxed. The income you make here is taxed here. We have a certain agreement with Wisconsin, but with other places, like if I lived in Iowa and worked up here half the time, half my income was up here, I'd be paying half my taxes on that half the income.
But, Mr. Chairman, I don't presume to be an expert, but you know, one of the things to keep in mind is if you're at the level of, you know, Shirley's Throne or whoever, the contracts you work out, as I understand them, with the production company or with the producer, you know, might cover that. So it's possible that that particular talent figures a way to minimize his or her tax liability. But the law is, as pointed out by Ms. Winter and the commissioner, remains the same. The thing to keep in mind, Mr. Chairman, relative to this is that what made Minnesota an enticing area in the first place was the local talent available. And when you had some of the films of the 90s come in here, the Mighty Duck movies, the Grumpy Old Men movies, obviously Fargo, you had the ability to bring your major talent in. If we take Grumpy Old Men, Jack Lemmon, Anne Margaret, Walter Matthau, you know, that was a major production. The producer was the guy who produced Animal House. And so that was not a kidding around production. But there was significant local talent in the movie. There was also significant crew, Minnesota crew, you know, who lived in the Twin Cities or elsewhere, who worked on those two particular productions. So that was something that was an enticement, given the acting talent that's available in Minnesota, given some of the technical ability that's there in terms of cinematography, the availability of places like 3M and that kind of technical back expertise, coupled with, obviously, the exterior shots. Grumpy Old Men was set, I only saw those movies once a piece, but, you know, one was fishing, one was ice fishing, one was in the summer. So they utilized, you know, the Minnesota outdoors. Mighty Ducks, obviously, was a hockey movie, so there was a natural connection. North Country was a movie set on the range and utilized the range, although it was striking that a lot of it was done on the range, but I believe actually more of it was done in New Mexico because they could get more significant incentives in New Mexico. Certainly this is anecdotal, Mr. Chairman, but the governor went up to Eveleth on the set of North Country, and I went up the day before to spend a little bit of time with the producer that morning. And I didn't make any plans as such. And when I drove up there, it was impossible to find a room in the area. I unwisely didn't make plans in advance. The area, and Mr. Chairman, you might be better aware as somebody with an adjacent district, but Senator Tomasoni can tell you that that area of the state for the couple of months they were shooting was just packed in terms of the spinoff economic activity, hotel rooms, restaurants, and that kind of spinoff activity. In terms of the direct activity, and that's what this is meant to show, there's significant activity. The other thing, let me just mention relative to this, because it follows up with Senator Limmer's question. In the 1990s, members might recall that the prior executive director, Randy Adamczyk, who's now in Chicago, had been at the Capitol, and he and I sat down in the early 90s and talked to him about the need to try to quantify what kind of economic activity there was. And he set up the template for what you have in front of you. And I was only on this committee, Mr. Chairman, my first term in the Senate, but when I became chairman of State Departments, which at that time had all the economic development accounts in it, I tried to see if you could utilize the same kind of model with other kinds of economic development funding that we did. And it didn't translate. This clearly produced more, this activity produced more dollars directly than most of the economic development monies we provide elsewhere, and can quantify it on a much better basis. That was certainly my experience in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And, Mr. Chairman, maybe you've been a little more sophisticated than I've been in the 2010s or the 2000s, but at least at the time it was fairly significant in terms of a dollar realized.
Senator Cohen, I think this is an important discussion for the committee to have because, you know, it could likely be that the revenue that comes in significantly is more than the tax credit that goes out. But let me just say, Representative Lencheski does not like tax credits. So, as in fact, I don't believe she has a tax credit in her bill. She's got an appropriation of some kind for this. But, Senator Cohen, we'll see how the discussions go in the conference committee. I thought it was helpful for the committee members to see one of the topic areas that we're discussing in the conference committee. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, one question about the bill. I noticed the rebate was 15%. The bill is now 20%. Mm-hmm. Somebody up here was saying of talk about bidding war and where mm-hmm. Connecticut and others are. This bill moves it to 20. What's the ultimate? Where do we ever stop before 100%?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Marty, one place, and Ms. Winter can comment more from an industry perspective, as I mentioned in our discussions with Mr. Graff as well as other producers, that's been the figure they use. Now, I guess your question is a legitimate one as to whether or not 5 years from now or 7 years from now, do all the producers around the country say, you know what, 32%. But that's been, over the history of these incentive programs, that's been an industry standard, give or take. And you would hope that, you know, it's up to 20%.
Mr. Chairman, what's the industry standard?
Well, it's 20% is the figure we've heard. You know, that's not hard and fast. If there are other reasons to come here, maybe a producer would accept less than that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to address that because there is a certain Wild West aspect to the whole incentive world, because it's not only incentives offered here, but we're really competing with the entire world. Honestly, Eastern Europe is big now, and as you know, New Zealand and Australia have become big places, mostly because of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. But and I guess that's sort of where I see my role, is because I don't want to get into a situation, nor do I want our state to get into it. I've lived here just about my entire life. I have no interest in us eating our own lunch. I don't see where that benefits anybody. I think you have to be reasonable about these things. I think we can very safely say that this is very revenue positive at 20%. I think other states who are driving these things up even further. There have to be, I'll give you an example. There's a film right now coming in July, Disney film looking at coming here in July. Seriously, they're looking at us, and they have a person here on the ground and a person in Arizona on the ground. They're only looking at two states. We both have incentives. What is going to draw that film here is the fact that we have an incentive, a decent incentive. We have the crew to help this guy make his movie, shooting it in Jordan. It's about a story set in an Arabian horse farm, which I didn't know this. We have two huge ones in Jordan. And what's going to bring them here over Arizona are two things. It's too hot in Arizona in July for anybody to stand around outside, and this is almost all exteriors. And number two, our talent pool, because they can fill in a lot of their roles here other than their two stars. They don't have that in Arizona either. So there's always a bunch of reasons why somebody selects a place to locate a production. But I can tell you that I share the concern of everybody going insane. Puerto Rico has a 40% incentive. But there are a lot of movies that can't shoot in Puerto Rico for a lot of obvious reasons. And the expenses on the ground there are outrageous. But I'm a conservative in this. I think we have to have what we need to compete, and then we have to sell our state on the other factors that make people want to shoot here. And we have to make sure that this program is doing what it's designed to do, which is create jobs and bring money into the state. And I think you have to be conservative. But I don't think that 20%, I think 20% is still it makes us more attractive. It puts us on par with the top 10 players. And it still ensures that we get the job done here.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cohen, I noticed on line 7 on page 1, you're requesting the Commissioner of Revenue to study the effectiveness of providing these tax incentives. And as I was looking at kind of this little job description of what you want the Commissioner to do, I'm wondering if maybe the Commissioner of Revenue is the appropriate commissioner to do that. And I'm just wondering, would perhaps maybe the Department of Economic Development, they kind of are the one that studies the effectiveness of incentives. And I'm just wondering if that was an oversight, or if that's what you want the Revenue Department to actually do.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, that's probably a good suggestion, although Commissioner Innes might, maybe he's dying to do this, so I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
But otherwise, that might be a good suggestion.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner, what do you think? You want?
Chairman, well, I do have a little bit of concern about this. Coming from Deed, I think they're better equipped.
Which one should come to the table?
Chairman, thank you. To that point, we'd be more than happy if we could do some revenue analysis and see what kind of revenue was possibly generated by the tax credit. But an overall analysis of the efficacy of the tax credit, I think, is more in the purview of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Bob Isaacson was mentioned. Mm-hmm. He's an employee of Deed. He's very effective at. They have a REMI model they can run down there to find out the ancillary economic benefits of a certain tax incentive or tax credit. I just think that we could be helpful in this endeavor, but I don't know if we should be the lead agency in judging this. It's just not our forte.
Sir Limmer, I think that's a good suggestion. Council has a suggested oral amendment.
I could say with the assistance of the commissioner.
Yeah.
Okay.
Council?
Mr. Chairman, members, the amendment would be on page 1, line 7. Before the insert, the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development with the assistance of, and then it would be with the assistance of the Commissioner of Revenue.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, that's probably the right department to send it to. I have a feeling the numbers will be about 10 times as big if you go through Deed as well. But so Senator Cohen will probably like that, but that's probably the right department.
Senator Pogemiller.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that Deed's going to have plenty of time. Senator Bach and the tax conference are trying to ease their burden on managing programs, and I think they're going to have plenty of time to work on this because this would actually be real economic development as opposed to just
everything else we've done in the past.
Senator Cohen, what do you think of the oral amendment?
It sounds fine, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer moves council's oral amendment. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. After no, motion prevails. The amendment's adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I do want to respond to Senator Marty's point, though, if
Senator
I might.
Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, I can tell you that in the work I did in the 90s on this, the numbers we had were not inflated. It was not the kind of grandiose things. And I mentioned that was exactly my concern when I had jurisdiction over all the economic development programs, was to try to see what the cause and effect was. And the numbers we had put together, at least for this particular program in the 90s, were not inflated.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, I'm not saying they are. These actually, when you're talking about a $1.7 million investment and $500,000 in direct payroll tax revenue, I have a feeling I would guess these numbers are fairly accurate. I just was making the observation that if it goes through Deed, I have a feeling your numbers will be much, much bigger. But that's just a...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, I've
done economic analysis.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, and I share that. That's why, again, I tried to see if there was not the ability to impose something uniform, again, when I had jurisdiction over those programs. But this one, I'm looking for real numbers, not made-up numbers. And Ms. Winter agrees with that. And Mr. Chairman, just a further anecdotal comment to Senator Marty's concern about, you know, where these incentives go. It's going to vary. what members have to believe in is that the state of Minnesota has something to offer in this regard. And sometimes, with a particular production, it might mean there has to be some dollars. By contrast, I mean, the two major productions that have revived the out-of-state productions coming here were, of course, North Country, and the other one was Prairie Home Companion. And there was very little by way of incentive with Prairie Home Companion, and it had major Meryl Streep and Tommy Lee Jones and so on. It was the combination of Robert Altman and Garrison Keillor that brought that film here. And in talking, I spent a little bit of time with the producer of that film. He was the Altman producer, and he made it clear that, and we talked about the incentives. He said, in the case of this particular production, and the Altman productions were always modest budget productions. He said in the case of this particular production, what's important is not the dollar amount. It's the fact that, you know, Garrison Keillor wants to make the movie here. This is a movie about his radio show. Altman wants to work with Keillor, et cetera. So it's always a mixture, and hopefully it's not always money. But in many cases, you do need this incentive.
Anything else, members? Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, I know we've had a very thoughtful and deep and robust discussion. I'd like to move the bill.
We had a little history, Senator Moore. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, just a question for you. The House provision on this, is that the one where they were funding it pending a budget surplus in the next budget forecast?
Senator Marty, committee members, and for Senator Pogelmiller's benefit, the House has some very creative language in their side-by-side, and it says that if there is a budget surplus after the November forecast, they then have an appropriation. So they make any surplus money after the November forecast. They make a program like this. They put it first in line. We had a pretty good discussion about that, Senator Murray. That's correct. I don't know that we're going to do it that way.
Mr. Chairman, that, you know, looking around the table, I think there are eight former members of the House, and then if you include myself, and Senator Marty's a former House staffer, so we know the House can be creative, but that's not my idea.
On the Moi motion, that Senate File 2276 as amended be recommended to pass. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you.
So, members, if there's some money available, you might see something coming back in the conference committee report. I thought we should take a look at what we're conferees are considering.
There's money available?
Senator Moi, members, this is another late introduction, in fact, real late. maybe on the calendar today, but Senate, you have the language in front of you, Senate File XXXX. This also is some provisions that's contained in the House side in the omnibus tax bill discussions. And as of today, I think we still don't have a good fiscal note on what this potentially costs. We'll ask the department if there's anything new on that. But the House did include provisions very much like this. And we're just not sure what the fiscal note is yet. We'll have the department speak to that. But I thought the committee should see this issue also. Senator Moi?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I felt that it was really important to bring this issue to the committee for a full discussion. And doing the work of the committee, I think that we should try to get the information to the committee and have the committee give some input. What this bill is going to be doing is we're actually looking to reverse a Minnesota Supreme Court decision. And because of that, we're actually going to be changing what is in current law. The bill will try to, or is going to be modifying the definition of the sales factor for sales of services to mutual funds. Under current law, these sales are treated as sales made to the mutual fund itself. So they are sourced to the mutual fund's fixed place of business. If this bill passes, or if we take the provision that's in the House, on the House side, what we will be doing is we'll making these sales, types of sales to mutual funds will be sourced based on the mailing address of the shareholders of the fund with computations made on a monthly basis. The language of the bill also says that if an insurance company is the shareholder, then the corporation or the entity selling services to the mutual fund is allowed to make an irrevocable election to treat the policyholders as the shareholders for purposes of this definition. And a similar option would not apply to institutional investors, such as administrators of 401ks plans, which would be treated as sales to the administrator of the plan. Again, I just think that it's important for us to have a discussion in the committee. This bill passes, or if we were to take this provision and were to become law, it would change current law, and it would reverse the Minnesota Supreme Court decision. I have with me today Mr. Brian Peach, who is in the legal department at Ameriprise, who would like to speak to the bill, and I'm sure the department would probably want to participate. I haven't had a chance to talk to the department, but I'm looking forward to that discussion.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Peach. I'm with Ameriprise Financial. We're proud to be a Minnesota-domiciled headquartered company. We're formerly American Express Financial Advisors and formerly IDS, so we have a long history of being a hometown company. Proud to be a Fortune 297 company debuting this year. We employ approximately 8,000 people in Minneapolis, own $350 million worth of real estate in the state, and are very committed here. We also have our mutual fund asset management business headquartered in the state, as well as our mutual fund board. And because of that, we're subject to a substantial tax penalty of double taxation. Under the current law, we have to source 100% of our asset management revenue for mutual funds to the state of Minnesota, and we have to source it to a significant other number of other states across the country. So we're paying 100% of our taxes here and a substantial portion in a number of other states. We manage about $156 billion in assets in the mutual fund industry and manage about 1.73% of the Minnesota mutual fund market. So it's a very small percent of the Minnesota market, but we pay a substantial amount of taxes here. And current law is trending contrary to the Lutheran Brotherhood tax decision that Senator Mao had mentioned. And the current trend is to source taxation to where the mutual fund shareholders are located. All of the major mutual fund domiciled states now have laws similar to what we're trying to effectuate. This would allow us to avoid double taxation if we could pass this, and we would have extra money to reinvest in our business and help grow to a bigger company. So I respectfully ask for your consideration.
Questions, members? Oh. Sir Limmer.
I have a related question, Mr. Chair. Sir, are these funds retirement funds?
Some of them are, yes, and some of them are just direct individual funds.
And as the growing trend toward taxing or having these products taxed according to the residence of that particular investor, we've had discussions from time to time about whether or not we're scaring our senior citizens away that are on retired incomes to other states that don't tax as high on their income tax. Are you noticing that as well in Minnesota?
You know,
people leaving the state because of tax complaints?
Well, I wouldn't be in a position to really comment on whether people are leaving because of the tax situation.
Right. Fair. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, just one quick question for Mr. Peach or Senator Moore. The language in here talking about the shareholders, I assume in mutual funds, that's because the shareholders are they're the investors. Is that typical? That's how we characterize this for all of these sorts of funds.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, that's correct. We look at the individual shareholders as a person that purchases the mutual fund as opposed to the mutual fund board.
Okay.
So it's the individual people.
Anything else, members? Thank you. This is a subject that's also in front of the conference committee, so I thought the full committee should see it. If we have a little money, we might do something on it. Mr. Manson, do we have an idea? Do we have a more up-to-date fiscal note on what this potentially costs? Or
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Jack Manson with the Department of Revenue. And Mr. Chairman, I think we're getting closer. The difficulty in this revenue estimate is that we can pretty much determine, based on our work with Mr. Peach, that kind of what the revenue loss will be based on the Minnesota-based corporations. It's kind of hard determining what we're going to pick up from non-Minnesota-based corporations who now will be sourcing into the state. So that's where we're struggling with the revenue estimate, but I think within the next day or two, I think we will have a revenue estimate for you.
Anything else, members, on this subject?
Thank you, Mr.
We'll
Chair.
Lay Senator Moy's Cinephile XXX on the table.
Nice explanation out here. Wait. It's one of the kids. Yeah, no, it's good. I understand. Yeah, what about it? It's true.
Members, we have House File 2294. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, House File 2294 is a small little bill for the Cook Ore Hospital District and the House took it up and passed it over. And the bill was sitting in this committee. It had the provisions of the bill have actually been incorporated into the omnibus tax bill, but the actual House Senate file is residing in the committee. So, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I have a delete all amendment to the House file. It's the A2 amendment.
Does everyone have the A2 amendment?
Yes. Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bach, I think that the A3 amendment has to be made to the A2 amendment. It is some language that...
Well, I think, Senator Skoy, I think we need to adopt the A2, which is a delete all, and then we'd move the A3 amendment to the delete all. Counsel, would that be the right way to do it?
Yes.
Senator Bach moves the A2 amendment, put the bill in the shape that he'd like. Is there further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a copy of the A3, but it's something that counsel suggested. So, I now have it. Mr. Chairman, I move the A3 and ask Mr. Nolan to come up. And this was a late night thought on his part, so he needs to tell me what we're changing here because I haven't seen it yet.
Thank you, Senator Bach. Mr. Nolan.
Mr. Chairman and members, the A3 amendment is designed to incorporate some of the, essentially it's line 8 on the spreadsheet, which I think has been handed out to you. Under the language of Article 1, there is a homestead credit state refund established, and as part of that, there is money that is generated in the 08-09 biennium that needs to be moved from one biennium to the next. So $129 million through this mechanism is moved into the fiscal 10-11 biennium. So money is set aside into that reserve, and then it is canceled back into the full general fund at the in the 10-11 biennium. And that's what this amendment does.
Thank you, Mr. Nolan. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nolan, what's the source of the revenue?
Mr. Nolan,
let's adopt the amendment, and then Senator Ortman, I'll speak to why, what the source is, and kind of how it works. But what, essentially, what we're doing is we're raising more revenue in the current biennium than we're spending, so we need to transfer some of the money from the current biennium into 10 and 11, so that the bill's in balance and we're in balance in the tails.
Senator Skoy moves the A3 amendment. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you. Senate file 2294 as amended. The provisions of it are the following. We have in the amendment picked up the House's fourth tier of the income tax. The 9% that we've all read about in the newspaper on joint households over $400,000 in income. So we've taken the House language on the fourth tier. We have then, which raises about $452 million per biennium. And we have spent that new income tax money on property tax relief. Every dime of it, that income tax money that's raised in this bill, is spent to buy down property taxes in two different ways. We also have incorporated in the amendment the House's proposal for a supercharged property tax refund, I think is what they're calling it. So an individual's, there's a cap on income on it. It phases out, but at $150,000, you're not eligible, household income, you're not eligible for the refund any longer. Up to $150,000, you will get a refund on a portion of your property taxes that exceed 2% of your income. So it's really kind of an enhanced circuit breaker program from what we have in current law. Provides for higher levels of income for people to qualify and has put significantly more money into the property tax refund program. The cost of it is about $223 million for the biennium. In addition to the property tax refund proposal in here, the balance of the income tax money that's raised is spent to buy down a number of different school levies. So that's the other portion of it. We buy down some of the operating levies that schools have, the, I guess we commonly refer to them as excess levy referendums, the voter-approved levies. We buy them down. We buy down the debt service equalization aid further. And the capital levy is also bought down. Anyway, the total of the levy buy-down for schools is the balance between the $452 million that the bill raises and the $223 million that goes into the property tax refund program. So the balance, the difference between there is all school-related property tax relief. So I just want to be clear, members, every dime of income tax money that's spent in this bill is spent on property tax relief either directly to the homeowner or to buy down school levies. And that's what that's the contents of the new bill.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, just a quick question about the circuit breaker program. The homeowner one goes up to $150,000 now, which is substantially higher than I think it is now. Was any thought given with the renter one? I think it's still, it looks like it's still capped at $60,000.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Marty. The renter's credit is also increased in here. Their income cap is raised and the dollar amount is increased. And the schedule is on.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, I see the schedule. What was the cap in the, 41.8. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Bach. With this, are you saying that you're rejecting the previous Senate position and you're adopting a new Senate or hoping to adopt a new Senate position that's more in line with the House?
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, no, I'm not rejecting the Senate position. The Senate position on property tax relief is contained in the Conference Committee on the omnibus tax bill, and we certainly are going to continue to fight for the Senate position in that conference committee. But we are, in the event that this session stalls and we're not able to get an omnibus tax bill out of this legislature, I think it's very critical that we make sure, at a minimum, we get real, meaningful property tax relief out of this session. And members, remember, Senate File 1 was property tax relief. So in the event, you know, that, and we only got 13 days left, we've got a number of vetoed bills, and, you know, the Tax Committee really can't finish its work until all the budget issues are all resolved on the omnibus tax bill. And I just, as the tax chair, I'm trying to make sure that my number one priority of this session gets accomplished, and that's to provide for property tax relief. And, you know, I don't control the other budget discussions and all the other committees that are negotiating the state budget, but I do know that we can't wrap up an omnibus tax bill until all those discussions are over. So I'm, as a safety valve, I'm just trying to make sure that before this session adjourns, we have the opportunity to get property tax relief.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Bach, I understand your position on property taxes, but I think that this proposal that you just talked about is in complete conflict with the Senate position on the income tax. And we had Senator Clark's bill. We passed that bill for a different income tax treatment. And so I'm wondering, are you rejecting that position in favor of the lower income tax bracket increase proposed by the House?
Senator Ortman, I'm trying to find a compromise with the governor that he can accept. And it was pretty obvious that the Senate provision on income tax, which is not in front of the conference committee because it is not contained in the conference committee on either bill that the conference committee on the omnibus tax bill is considering. So The Senate provision is not something that that conference committee is considering. We are considering the House provision. So that is, the House seems very comfortable with that provision. It's in the discussions in the conference committee, trying to make sure that we find something that the House is willing to do and that I think extends an olive branch to the governor that that we can get some property tax relief. And remember, the Senate bill that passed paid for not only property tax relief, but also for additional education spending. So the Senate income tax increase was higher than this. This proposal is an effort to reach out to the governor and to the House and say, it's for me as an author, that property tax relief is the reason I came to the legislature this year, and it is my number one priority, and I want to make sure that we get it. So this is a lower income tax rate than the Senate considered before. It's pared down spending. We've pared the spending down to only property tax relief. And I'm hopeful that the House would be willing to consider something like this. I know they were very concerned that the Senate's income tax increase was too high. But I do think the House also would like to make sure we get property tax relief out of this session. Don't know exactly how they're going to react to this. They probably will call it some kind of a stealth attack by the Senate on the House because this is a pretty small bill coming over to us. But I don't think we should run the risk in the final days of this session that somehow property tax relief falls on the floor, because I don't think that's acceptable. So I think getting it to the governor early before the omnibus tax bill discussions are concluded, I think will help assure that we get property tax relief out of this session.
Is Senator Pogemiller to this point, and then Senator Limmer. Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach has visited with me about this approach. I just want to mention, and I think I know Senator Bach knows this, but what this tax committee put together was a two-pronged approach. One was property tax relief for homeowners, but the other also was creating some fiscal stability and rebuilding the state-local fiscal relationship with cities and schools and counties. And as I understand this approach, that rebuilding of the fiscal relationship between cities, counties, and the school districts is in the tax committee still. And so I don't think that this prejudices that portion. I do see, Senator Bach, that property tax relief to homeowners, this is it, kind of. And so I'm hoping that your attempt to bring a compromise between the House and the governor is successful. I have questions, frankly, about the supercharged PTR approach as a policy. But, you know, I'm willing to work with my conferees. They've all convinced me, I guess, that this may be an attempt to break the logjam. But I just want to reiterate that I think the other component of the Senate approach to rebuild that state-local fiscal relationship, the Minnesota Miracle, is still weighing heavily on my mind.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bach, as the attempt to balance or equalize levies or buy down school operating levies, how would that be determined over the overall list of school districts? Who would get the benefit? Who would not? Who gets the greatest benefit? Is there an equation to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, Mr. Nauman can certainly explain much better. I don't think there's anybody in this building knows more about school financing than he does, so I'd like him to answer if I could.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I think this might be a good time to pass out that data run that we had, if that hasn't already been passed out, because I think it does provide. So, Senator Limmer, I'm seeing that it's probably sitting in front of you. And if you take a look at it across school districts, I think you can see where the relief is provided. We put this data run together in consultation with some of the House staff, because there's a lot of House initiatives in this proposal. I'm going to work from the right side over to the left. There, as Chairman Bach mentioned, there's a couple of actually three or four different policy initiatives or policy levers that are pulled for the purposes of property tax relief. The operating capital is a revenue line inside the general education formula that provides revenue to school districts for the purposes of, you know, textbooks and computers and leasing land in some cases. And that program in 2003 was converted into an aid levy mix program and then enhanced on the levy side in the 2005 session. This kind of takes us in the opposite direction. We adjust the equalizing factor upward, which reduces the amount of levy that's required in that. It doesn't change any revenue that school districts get, but it reduces the levies. So you can see on the far right columns that the aid goes up by $57.4 million and the levy goes down. The voter-approved operating referenda of the next two columns, again, moving right to left, or from the right side over to the left, the referendum is increased on the aid side. Again, we're adjusting equalizing factors to provide some more aid into the system. So we're adding 21 points, roughly $6 million in aid. Then the House had two initiatives on the debt service program. One was just a straight elimination of the two tiers of debt service and then equalizing the debt service program at the statewide average of ANTC per pupil. And that's the debt increase in aid. The House also had an additional proposal that would provide a credit equal to 36% of land that is ag or timberland, excluding a house, garage, and 1 acre of land. And there's a mechanism in the language of Article 2 to provide state revenue directly to school districts to reimburse them for lost revenue as a result of that credit. So that's direct property tax relief as well. And that's about $18 million. So those are the collection of policy levers that are included in Article 2.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limbach, I noticed on page 17 of the bill, or the delete everything, the A2 amendment, I think that's what we're on. I noticed that as we change the rates of taxation on income tax, you still have retained the fourth tier, the new 9% fourth tier. I think what you had before was 9.75 or 9.85, something like that before. That certainly would have brought Minnesota up to the highest income tax bracket in the country. I don't know if 9% is alleviating any heartburn of mine on that, but a tax increase is a tax increase. I see what you're doing in trying to take that new revenue and apply it back to buy down school operating levies, and that's basically what we're doing on this.
Senator Bach?
Senator Larson, that's correct. And on page 17, lines 29 through 31, members just need to remember that all we're doing there is adjusting those numbers for inflation. Reflects current law, just the inflation adjustment that we're currently using. So it's not a change in anybody's tax liability on lines 29 through 31.
Is there any further discussion? Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Bach, support your effort to provide property tax relief. This is some of these provisions the property tax division had looked at and considered, and I think they're a very good addition to this House file. Just so everybody is clear, this really is revenue neutral to Minnesotans. It's changing property taxes into income taxes paid. I think it's a good direction and support your effort here.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
I noticed on page 18 we make reference to married, unmarried individuals on income tax. I'm trying to remember what benefit we gave marriage credits versus individuals that are not married. Are we doing any damage to that status in this proposal?
Senator Buck.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I might have to ask counsel, but I don't believe we make any changes there.
Ms. Zoff.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, no, the marriage credit that has been in existence will continue to apply. So I don't think there's going to be a disproportionate disadvantage to married taxpayers under this proposal. All
right. Senator Bach, significant property tax relief. This is obviously you've done a lot of hard work here, and it's an opportunity to try to move forward and find some compromise. Is there any further discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
On that note, there may be significant property tax relief, but what significant income tax increases are we really experiencing in this? What's the total new money that we're raising?
Senator Limmer, in 08-09, there's $452.7 million. In 10 and 11, there is $452 even. So that is about $904 million for the next 4 years, and every dime is spent on property tax relief.
Okay.
Well, you could argue it's just a shift. You raise income taxes, you buy down property taxes. That's what we're hoping to accomplish. You know, we all know, and everybody in this room knows, that property taxes are a regressive tax. This is my effort to try and make Minnesota's tax system slightly less regressive. It'll still be a regressive tax system, but it moves us a little bit closer to having a progressive tax system, at a minimum less regressive than it is today.
Mr. Chair.
Senator St. John.
Senator Bach, how do the local government aid provisions fit into all this, or do they?
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Senator St. John, there are none in here. The local government aid provisions, the county aid provisions, the township aid provisions that we had are a subject of the conference committee discussions on the omnibus tax bill.
Okay.
And, you know, the House had this supercharged rebate idea, and they really seem wed to it. And I thought that in an effort to try and accommodate the House, we would take their income tax rate and take their property tax refund program, in hoping that we could get them to agree to send something forward so we get some property tax relief in the event, Senator St. John, that the Conference Committee on the Tax Bill doesn't come to a final conclusion. You know, and we haven't been able to restore that state-local fiscal relationship that I think you certainly appreciate. What state has some obligation, I think, to help local units of government provide services, and we do that through local government aid. We do it to counties with county program aid, and we're going to try and work on that relationship in the omnibus tax bill. But in the event that we fail and we don't manage to get an omnibus tax bill passed this session, at a minimum, this is my effort to make sure that homeowners get property tax relief out of this session. And I'm hopeful, don't know, but I'm hopeful that the House is, you know, we've tried to include their stuff, hopefully that we can get them to agree to this. But I'm just a little nervous that somehow we end up with no property tax relief. So I really... This is an effort to try and reach out to the House by including a bunch of their things to make sure that we get property tax relief for homeowners. Doesn't get us totally where I'd like to get. I mean, in the omnibus tax bill discussions, I really want to do more to restore that relationship, the partnership between state and local government, and I hope that we can accomplish that in the omnibus tax bill. But at a minimum, we got to make sure we provide some help for homeowners. And this is my effort to do that.
Seeing no further discussion, Senator Bach moves that House File 2294, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bach.
I don't believe we have any other